Chief Judge and Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case is United States against Webb. I announced at the beginning that the motions and responses filed by the parties on the jurisdiction of the question have been taken under advisement, and the court will act on the written filings in due course. Today's oral argument will focus on the two issues briefed by the parties regarding the post-trial orders issued by the military judge. This is a certified case. Counsel for the government.
Major Donna Rappel, and I, along with Colonel Gerald Bruce, represent the government in this matter. There are two issues presented in this case. First, whether the military judge abused her discretion in granting the defense motion for new trial. And second, whether prior to authentication, the military judge has the authority in a post-trial 39A session to set aside a conviction and order a new trial as a remedy for a discovery violation discovered post-trial. The government asserts that the military judge abused her discretion in particular two ways, and that currently a strict reading of the statute and case law don't specifically provide the military judge the proper authority for the action. I will address them in order. First, in regards to the first issue, upon the defense discovery of the observer's Article 15 action, they submitted a motion for a post-trial 39A and a request for a new trial. The defense argued a due process violation in accordance with Brady versus Maryland. And the government response mainly focused on RCM 1210 and specifically the third prong of RCM 1210. The military judge in her ruling essentially applied the analysis for a new trial under RCM 1210 and made passing reference to parts of the Brady analysis and its progeny. This court should review the military judge's ruling on a petition for new trial for an abuse of discretion. And in order to find an abuse of discretion, this court should look to if the findings upon which the military judge predicated her ruling are not supported by the evidence of record, or two, incorrect legal principles were used by her in deciding this motion, and finally, three, if her application of the correct legal principles to the facts of a particular case is clearly unreasonable. In regards to the first prong, the government's position is that the findings which the military judge predicated her ruling on are not supported by the record. In particular, the military judge erred when she relied heavily on the incorrect premise that each time the observer signed the observer briefing, he was making a false official statement. In her conclusion, the military judge stated that Tech Sergeant Herring's non-judicial punishment action, his subsequent false analysis observer statements, as well as the misfeasance of trial counsel, could conceivably create a reasonable doubt that did not exist during the accused's earlier trial. And in fact, the government's position is that the observer memorandum that Tech Sergeant Herring signed actually just stated that his signature acknowledged he received the briefing regarding his duties. It was not a signature attesting that he did not have an Article 15 or certifying that he did not have an Article 15.
Therefore, is your view that this document is only susceptible to that reading?
Well, it's the government's position that that document is not an attestment of Sergeant Herring that he did not have an Article 15.
The document says you may not have had an unfavorable information file or ever had an Article 15 non-judicial punishment, blah, blah, blah. I have read and been given an oral brief by demand reduction personnel and or the legal office of observer duties and responsibilities. So it's your view that the duties and responsibilities do not relate to not ever having had an unfavorable information file or ever had an Article 15?
Well, the government's argument actually isn't that those don't relate. It's more that his signature is not certifying that he is qualified as described or that he meets the requirements of the observer duties as explained above. Further, in his stipulation of expected testimony, he stated that when he signed the observer memorandum, he was signing that he received the briefing. And the military judge, in her findings of fact, actually specifically stated that each time...
Which paragraph you were in, please, of the findings?
Paragraph 2. The military judge states that on that date, as well as on 6 occasions prior and 3 occasions subsequent, Sergeant Herring had received an observer's briefing and signed memoranda stating he never received an Article 15 for a false official statement or other dishonesty offenses. And the government's position is that that is not, in fact, what he signed as far as what Tech Sergeant Herring believed he signed. And for the offense of false official statement, there is an element of an intent to deceive, which if you look at Sergeant Herring's stipulation of expected testimony, that was not in evidence in this case.
Is it your view that this document is not a Brady document? Regardless of your view on the interpretation of the document, are you arguing that this was not required to be disclosed to the appellant?
Specifically, are you talking about the Article 15 itself?
Right.
Well, that argument would go to the materiality under Brady, and the government's position is that the Article 15 of the observer was not material. However, the government is not going to argue that the document shouldn't have been turned over to the defense, because clearly it was a document that should have been turned over to the defense in a timely manner. However, in analysis post-trial under Brady versus Maryland, the document does not rise to the level of materiality in this particular case under these facts.
I'm having a little trouble squaring your false official statement analysis with the argument we heard last week by the government in another case in which an individual was accused of stealing computers, and when he was asked what happened to the computers, he said, I looked at the stack and they weren't there anymore. A statement which, of course, was true, and the government argued that it was false in context. How is this statement true in context when it says you may not have an unfavorable information file, including Article 15? In the end, it says put your signature and other information below acknowledging you've read and understand your duties and observer may be called upon to testify as a witness in legal proceedings. How could a person perform their duties as an observer or testify in legal proceedings if they knew they had an Article 15?
Well, Your Honor, clearly, Tech Sergeant Herring, knowing he had an Article 15, should not have been an observer. However, he is appointed by his commander or first sergeant to serve in these duties. When he reads the briefing and he gets to the bottom and it says, I have read and been given an oral brief of observer duties and responsibilities, sign here. The government's position is that that is not, in and of itself, a false official statement.
Now, so when an airman is given the responsibility for engaging in a physical task, and he's told that in order to complete this mission for the unit, you have to be in the following physical condition, and he signs at the end saying, I understand my duties, and the mission fails because he was not in his physical condition, he can't be prosecuted for making a false official statement at that point.
No, Your Honor. The government's position is that there is certainly the argument and the availability of disciplinary action based upon this document here. However, in order for a false official statement, intent to deceive is an element that must be proven. There was no... Per se, disciplinary action taken on Sergeant Herring regarding this. There was no ability for him to defend himself in regards to this. And the mere signing of this briefing here, just based on what it reads above the signature, does not in and of itself constitute 6 different offenses of false official statement.
Counsel, let me ask you some questions that focus on this issue in a slightly different way. Would you agree that when someone is charged with drug use, that there's really 3 possible defenses? 1, that it was innocent ingestion. 2, that there was a problem with the urinalysis procedure at the command. And 3, that there's a problem with the drug lab. Do you agree that those are basically the 3 defenses you have?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in this case, the observer, would you agree that the observer should not, based on the Air Force instruction, have been an observer?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you also agree that regardless of what you think of the false official statement, that the NJP and the charges that the NJP were there for would have been good grounds for impeachment of his credibility at trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how did the military judge abuse her discretion in suggesting that there would have been a substantially more favorable result to the accused in this case if he could have had one of the three defenses and didn't have it because he didn't have this information?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me address that.
Because, I mean, it seems to me that should be the focus of what you're arguing, not all this stuff about the intricacies of a false official statement charge.
Yes, Your Honor. And with that, I'll just move on to the second part of my argument, which is that the military judge incorrectly applied legal principles in deciding the motion, and actually the appellee in this case appears to agree based on their brief, but for a different reason. And the appellee's brief argues that the military judge should have applied the Brady analysis and not the rule for courts martial 1210. Obviously, the government's position is that the military judge, that the proper standard to be applied in this case is RCM 1210, and that's based on this court's holding in United States versus Johnson. And under RCM 1210, providing that a new trial may be granted on grounds of newly discovered evidence, the newly discovered evidence needs to meet one of the three prongs. The evidence was discovered after trial, that it wouldn't have been discovered at trial in the exercise of due diligence, and third, the main issue in this case, the newly discovered evidence, is, if considered by a court-martial in light of all other pertinent evidence, would probably produce a substantially more favorable result. And the military judge, in her conclusion, actually began by summarizing those three prongs and actually stated it is probable in light of all other evidence that the newly discovered evidence would have produced a substantially more favorable result. However, then she continues on in her conclusion, essentially describing her application of the legal principles in this case, which is what the government argues is demonstrating her error, in that she states the Article 15 subsequent false official statements and the misfeasance of trial counsel could conceivably create a reasonable doubt that did not exist during the accused's earlier trial. Obviously, the standard that she is discussing there is a could versus a would, a could conceivably versus a would probably. And then she goes on further to apply the legal standard that was enunciated in United States in the Bagley case, where there is a reasonable likelihood that this new evidence could have affected the judgment of the members. So she was knitting together various legal standards in her conclusion. And as a matter of fact, in the post-trial 39A session, when counsel were presenting arguments to the military judge, she herself seemed a little bit confused at that point in time when she quoted that the burden has become all muddied at this point, so she was going to allow the counsel to just continue arguing as long as they had something new to add. So the government's position, additionally, is that the newly discovered evidence would not have produced a substantially more favorable result for the appellant, and that's for numerous reasons. First, that the observer's duty in your analysis program is really to ensure that the provider of the specimen is not either replacing the urine with somebody else's urine or otherwise adulterating the test or invalidating the test. Additionally, the observer provides a witness to the chain of custody aspect for the person acting as Ms. Stinson did in this case when the bottle is out of her hands until it's back into her hands again. And essentially, the observer's duties and responsibilities are to ensure against false negative tests, not to create false positive tests. And so that's an important aspect to keep in mind when looking at the fact that the observer had an Article 15 5 years prior, which certainly is relevant.
Well, if one of the observer's duty is to serve as a witness to the integrity of the chain of custody, doesn't his credibility isn't his credibility rather important?
Yes, Your Honor, his credibility is important, and the government's not trying to say that it is not important. Certainly, he could have been cross-examined on the fact that he had an Article 15, that it was for filing a false claim, crimen falsi. That could have gone on, certainly. However, in this case, under the facts that we have, that information in and of itself would not have produced a more favorable result to the accused, because what the role the observer played in this case was essentially watching the appellee provide the specimen and return it and initial off and ensure the tamper resistance.
You don't think that springing this kind of thing on a witness couldn't have produced a more favorable result? This kind of impeachment on a witness, you know, don't you know in Article 15 for lying? Well, yes, sir. You know, boring in on that. You don't think that could produce a more favorable result?
The government's position is under these facts, no. And the reason being that the observer's role in the overall process of this trial was minimal. And it was so minimal that the defense didn't even feel the need to interview the witness prior to stipulating to his testimony. So clearly, both Ms. Stenson and Tech Sergeant Herring.
Do you think they might have changed their approach if they had known about this?
Obviously, the argument from the appellee is that, yes, their strategy would have been wholly different. However, that's easy to say now, hindsight 2020, but if you look at the case in which they would have presented.
As easy to say as it is to say it had no impact.
I'm sorry, I missed the first
part. Well, the government's position is that this would have had no impact on the outcome. A substantial probability of changing the results.
That is correct.
And that's no more abstract than saying this might have changed the defense strategy. Two abstractions.
However, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. However, the government would disagree in that because the military judge in her findings of fact also did this, as well as the appellee. But the concept that they're putting forth is that you can essentially travel back in a time machine and start all over again. And that's not, in fact, the case, because in making this analysis, the court needs to look at all pertinent evidence as we stand here today. And that pertinent evidence includes testimony by the appellee at trial. And in that testimony, the appellee stated that there was no problems with the bottle. It was his urine in the bottle. He watched the tamper-resistant tape be applied. But also, that cuts both ways, because the appellee also, in his original trial, testified under oath at least three, if not four times that he did not use cocaine, and additionally testified and put forth his entire defense of innocent or unknowing ingestion. So if you take the defense argument that had we known this, it would have been a different strategy and the appellee wouldn't have testified at trial. And you look at that case, that's a wholly different case, but it is not going to produce a substantially more favorable result, because what you would have then is a case where the defense attacks the collection process at Kirtland Air Force Base based solely on an Article 15 by the observer with no other evidence.
I break you out of your chain of thought. Is the government appealing a big legal issue here, or is this all about just the outcome of this case? What's the big principle of law that the government is appealing through the Article 62 mechanism?
Well,
if any, or is this just about how this case comes out?
The government is appealing twofold. A, the military judge applying the proper standard, in other words, stating whether RCM 1210 is a proper standard and whether she applied those principles correctly. Additionally, the government's position is that the military judge, under these facts and circumstances, did not have the proper authority to grant a new trial. And that's based upon the strict language in Article 73.
So on the first issue, certainly the government's not here because it's an important principle to establish that if people have unfavorable NJPs for honesty, they should serve as your analysis observers, right? That's not the big principle of law you're trying to establish.
No, Your Honor.
But this is a your analysis case, and the government's chosen to appeal it rather than just redo it. In the abstract, if this were a, let's say the document, I'm trying to make a pure Brady hypothetical. The document says, this is the wrong appellant. This is not his your analysis. We thought you'd like to know that, government. And that's our document here. And the government's up here arguing that the judge should not have reopened that was off the table to the judge. In the government's view, how should then that Brady information have been applied in this case, in a case?
Well, the government's position is not that the military judge didn't have the authority to do a post-trial preliminary session and look at the evidence. However, the government's position...
But not the authority to do anything about it, or what is the government objecting to?
The government's objecting to the granting of a new trial based upon...
So in my scenario, they get the thing saying, lo and behold, this isn't even the person who should have been tried. And the judge is supposed to say, well, that's very interesting. I'm sorry I can't grant you a new trial. Good luck on appeal.
No, the government's position is that the military judge can convene a post-trial 39A session and take in all of the evidence and then submit a recommendation to the convening authority.
That notwithstanding the fact this is the wrong person in my court, I'm nonetheless forwarding to the convening authority a verdict of guilty for someone who I now know is innocent. And I hope you use your clemency wisely.
I'm assuming, Your Honor, that your hypothetical puts the timing outside the range of declaring a mistrial, which, of course, the military judge has.
The same timing as in this case.
It's arguable whether or not the military judge could have, at that point, declared a mistrial. However, that was not the question in this case, and therefore...
Because you're arguing a fundamental jurisdictional thing vis-a-vis the judge, which can't have anything to do with the nature of the information. Whether the court had jurisdiction under 39A or not can't depend on whether they had a really good Brady case or not.
Right, right.
Either they do or they don't have the jurisdiction.
Right.
So I'm trying to tell you they have a really good Brady case, indeed a Brady case of innocence. And according to the government's argument here, I think the government's view is, wonderful, that's for the CA to deal with using the clemency authority.
And the government's position is based solely on the analysis under the granting of a new trial, because the new trial is what is considered under Article 73.
Okay, and your position is that Article 73 does not allow the judge to do anything until the convening authority acts?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, where does Article 73 say anything about what can happen before the convening authority acts?
It doesn't, Your Honor. It's specifically.
Is there any case law upholding your position? Isn't this a remedial provision which should be construed liberally, and doesn't your position basically make hash of it?
Well, Your Honor, the government's position is that, pardon me, a strict reading of Article 73 trumps the general reading of RCM 1102. And
I didn't ask you that. I asked you about the statutory construction issue.
Well, Your Honor, the government's position is that if this court feels that adhering to the strict reading of Article 73, then that it may be something that needs to be changed under the law, however...
Okay, so the judge is powerless to act until a convening authority acts, and the only entity can fix that is Congress.
The judge is not necessarily powerless to act.
The judge is powerless to grant a new trial until the convening authority acts. Isn't that the way you're interpreting this statute?
Yes, Your Honor. That's right. The government's interpretation.
Okay.
Counsel, are you finished?
Is there any case law holding that interpretation?
Well, Your Honor, there is case law that certainly discussed this issue. However, the government's argument is that that case law, as of to date, has been dicta in the sense of these particular facts have not been put forth where this court has made such a ruling that would be precedent.
Thank you.
Until the military judge authenticates the record of trial and forwards it to the convening authority, who does the case belong to?
military judge. A military judge has the authority under RCM 1102 if it meets the requirements of RCM 1102.
So why couldn't a military judge under RCM 1102B2 in a post-trial 39A session say, I'm hearing new evidence that I think affects the legal sufficiency of the findings of the court-martial?
And the government's position is that the military judge couldn't, we're not saying the military judge can't determine that. However, based upon Article 73, which is a statute that is very specific about
what happens after it's in the convening after the convening authority's action, it doesn't say anything about what happens before the convening authority's action, does it?
No, Your Honor. It talks about petition for new trial may be requested from the judge advocate general after convening authority action. That's what Article 73 says. So 1102 is talking about general remedies. And the government's argument is that the statute, with its specificity, trumps the rule 1102.
Okay, so would you rather have the rule be that we're going to say that under 1102 in a post-trial, in a post-trial 39A session, a military judge can hear evidence and make a determination, and we're not going to call it a new trial, we're not going to make it subject to 73 or to 1210, we're just going to have it be a remedial action under 1102 that they can do on a less stringent basis. Why couldn't that be the rule?
Well, I guess that there's no reason why that couldn't be the rule. However, that's not the rule right now. And a lot of the government's argument is based upon the fact that there isn't any precedent thus far that allows for the granting of a new trial in a post-trial 39A.
Thank you, Counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court, I'm Captain Tim Cox, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, represent Sergeant Webb, the appellee in this case. The case in which Sergeant Webb asked this court to agree that a military judge does have the authority post-trial to grant a new trial for a government's discovery violation, and that the military judge in this case did not abuse her discretion in doing so. Turning to the first certified issue. On page 19 of the brief, the government argues that appellee is receiving a windfall. But that's not true. Sergeant Webb merely asked if the military judge agreed that he was denied his constitutional right to a full and fair trial. The military judge in concluding this, based on the government's discovery violation, was based on correct factual findings and reasonable application of legal principles. There's nothing unreasonable with her ultimate conclusion. This was a 112 alpha case, and the government's sole evidence of Sergeant Webb's use of cocaine was a positive urinalysis. There was no incriminating admissions. There was no eyewitness. So the integrity of the drug testing process and collection and testing was critical for the government's case. But in this case, the observer, an important person in this collection process, had an Article 15 for three dishonesty offenses: false official statement, filing a fraudulent claim, and attempting to obtain money fraudulently from the government. And despite a specific discovery request for this information 7 months prior to trial, and despite trial counsel learning that the observer had received an Article 15 3 months prior to trial, the defense never learned of it. And as a result, they were forced into making certain limited tactical and strategic decisions. I don't think anyone in this courtroom or anywhere else disputes the fact that trial counsel had an obligation to discover and disclose this Article 15. No one should. Nor should anyone misunderstand its significance. And a military judge certainly did not do so in this case. This Article 15 and all that involved was of a nature that, if used effectively, does undermine the confidence in the outcome of Sergeant Webb's trial. The cross-examination of the observer is obvious. You are the observer in this urinalysis. You will play an important role in the urinalysis collection. It's so important that, if necessary, you might be called to testify before a court-martial. As part of that role as being an observer, you sign official documents. And in fact, you've signed official documents falsely in the past before, haven't you? And it doesn't end there, because then Sergeant Herron is asked, that he received an offer 15 for this false suspicious statement, filing a fraudulent claim, and attempting to obtain money fraudulently. And he'd have to agree, and he'd be confronted with Air Force instructions and local based instructions that says you are therefore ineligible.
Counsel, not to interrupt you, but I think all the things that you're talking about now are in your brief and we understand them. Can you address specifically the intersection of Article 73, 1102, and 1210, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Article 73 sets forth the procedures for petitions for a new trial. What this court said in United States versus Williams is that it was modeled on the procedures used in federal district courts. We all know that in federal district courts, these types of motions occur all the time. 1102 authorizes a military judge so long as it's prior authentication, because as you mentioned, Judge Ryan, and at least government counsel seem to concede, was that the military judge still owns the case prior to authentication. And the military judge is authorized to conduct a post-trial Article 39A session if something comes to light that might undermine the confidence in the outcome of the proceedings. 1210, of course, implements Article 73. What this court has seemed to say in United States versus McDonough was that in SCAF, this court removed all substantive distinction between RCM 1102 and 1210. What this court did in United States versus SCAF, if I read it correctly, it told the military judge in that case that once the requested witnesses are produced, and if they give you evidence that gives you reason to grant, feel a need to grant a legal remedy, such as a new trial, then you are empowered to do so. So,
would it be fair to say, and I guess this is maybe a distinction without a difference, but it seems to make a difference to me, is what the military judge did in this case, an action under 1102 that referenced the standards under 1210, or was it a 1210 action? Because it seems to me that if you're arguing it was an action under 1210 or Article 73, that would be contradicted by the language of that rule and that statute. But if what your argument is that it was an 1102 action that referenced the standard for a new trial from those other sources, that would make a lot more sense.
And it would be the latter. It was an 1102 action using the standards in 1210. And I think the military judge made that relatively clear in the ruling. But if not, even though this court recognized, I believe it was in Johnson, that the appropriate standards to apply would be 1210 in a post-trial Article 39 intercession. Now, this Article 15 was not limited to being used against the observer. It was also the 10 documents he signed subsequent to receiving that Article 15 in the 4 years since that he had served as an observer that said that he had not received an Article 15. It's still a false statement. Whether it's going to be characterized as a false official statement that subjects him to punitive action, the statement and by his signature is false. And he's going to be confronted with those 10 statements as well on the witness stand. The entire drug testing program at Kirtland Air Force Base therefore becomes subject to attack. It's not just this important role played by the observer whose credibility is subject to attack, but it's the integrity of the entire sample. That doesn't render the sample inadmissible because it's so unreliable, but the reliability of that sample is crucial for the government to prove, as well as something that the defense is entitled to attack.
Do you know if there's any case law that talks about the operation and the validity of your analysis when the observer is per se not eligible to be an observer under the Air Force instruction?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe there would be any case that says merely because you're ineligible to test or be an observer, that means that the statement is inadmissible or would be grounds for reversal. But that's probably because there's never been very many cases where an Article 15 for dishonorable defenses has never been brought before an appellate court for an observer. The fact of the matter is, again, there's no dispute that this 15 should have been turned over, and the reasonable prosecutor would have turned it over upon learning of it.
Given the state of the evidence in this case, including the lack of tampering with the sample and so forth, how does the fact that he was 5 years ago a liar affect the chain of custody and in fact affect the outcome? How do you answer the government's argument that he's so extraneous to the process under these facts that it wouldn't have changed the outcome?
Well, he's not extraneous to the process. He's only looks to be extraneous by virtue of the fact that the defense didn't know what they should have known. And the fact that this Article 15 might have been 5 years old doesn't change the fact that in the 4 years since, he is still serving in a capacity in which, by regulation, he's not allowed to. Now, that's not, as the government has told us, is not a decision he gets to make.
He's not extraneous as an assertion, but what's the response to Judge Stuckey based on the record? What, in fact, does he do in court, according to the record?
He establishes...
So far, all we know is he does nothing.
He establishes the chain of custody of the sample as part of the process of how it gets collected, packaged, and shipped for testing.
Where in the record do a specific page site you'd like to draw our attention to?
Well, it would be...
Or the military judge's findings, but this is your chance to do the tic-tac-toe.
Well, the evidence would be contained in Sergeant Herron's stipulation of expected testimony. The military judge, recognizing that in a naked urinalysis case in the findings of fact, conclusions of law, where innocent ingestion is a potential defense, the fact of the matter is the reliability of that collection of that specimen is reasons for members to conclude that there might have been unknowing or not wrongful ingestion, not merely because it might have happened in a bar or in a restaurant or some other reason posited by defense counsel through his cross-examination of the expert, but it's not limited to just those situations. You have a test result that depends on the integrity of every single person involved in it, not just the observer, but those who select the observer, those who train the observer, and then also we have in Prosecutor Exhibit 4 the drug testing litigation package, which shows an additional 25 other people involved in the handling of the specimen. So if there's one thing wrong with the observer, it necessarily raises the question, what else is wrong?
To what extent, if at all, does it make a difference that in a stipulation of fact or expected testimony says, I am pretty confident I watched the urine leave Staff Sergeant Webb's body, and I do not believe there was anyone else in the bathroom. Is that relevant to your argument or not?
It's relevant.
Here I'm referring to the qualifications of pretty confident and I do not believe.
Well, it's relevant because what Mrs. Stinson provided her stipulation of expected testimonies, we need to have trustworthy individuals because it's so important to have this process be done correctly. And by stipulation of expected testimony suggesting that I believe this or I'm pretty confident of that indicates that this observer might not be the most trustworthy individual in the world in and of itself. Add to that the fact of an Article 15 where he should have been there in the first place.
Well, why can't we take what he said exactly the opposite of the way that you've just suggested, which is that he's, you know, saying he's not saying I'm 100% positive that I saw X and I saw Y. He's saying I'm reasonably certain and I'm pretty sure. Why isn't that more honest than why isn't that, because that's not as good for the government, is it?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
The government would rather have a witness that comes and says, I am 100% positive that I saw X.
Absolutely.
Than someone who said, I'm reasonably certain that I saw X.
That's correct. But again, in making arguments regarding how credible is this sample overall, when you have someone who's going to equivocate or at least not give the 100% certainty answer, anything else, especially that directly undermines his credibility, would allow the defense counsel, as they should have been able to do, destroy the credibility. What else could possibly be wrong with this sample?
But see, what you're not doing is tying up for us what could possibly be wrong with this sample to this witness. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, it's his involvement in ensuring the chain of custody as one clog in the wheel of establishing this reliability, so that when the military judge instructs the members, we may give the weight and significance as you see fit to this evidence. And absent evidence to the contrary, you can presume that it was done properly and regularly. But there was no evidence that the defense was able to do to counter that. And so the members were able to accept, as trial counsel argued to them, that everything was done properly. There is nothing wrong with the sample. But we know otherwise that there is reason to question it. And it's not a function of would Sergeant Webb necessarily earn an acquittal. It's whether or not there is reason to question confidence in the outcome of this trial.
How do you answer the government's due diligence argument that by asking about two questions of the observer, the defense could have found this out?
Sure, but at the same time, the defense sent a specific discovery request seeking the exact information that was withheld from them. due diligence doesn't require a scorch of the earth.
Well, they didn't send a specific discovery request that said, does Tech Sergeant What's-His-Name have an Article 15 for lie? They said, yield up any derogatory information, any irrelevant information. That's a general rather than a specific request.
Well, actually, I mean, the request was any potential government witness, if they've ever had an Article 15,
right,
give it to us. I think it goes without saying that in a urinalysis case, the observer is going to be a potential government witness. In light of that, there's no reason for the defense to think that if an observer had an Article 15, they knew if that was true, it was going to come to them in response to the discovery request. Number two, at being military defense counsel, surely they were aware of the instructions that said if you have an Article 15, you're not allowed to be an observer.
So basically what you're saying is that they were allowed to rely on their discovery request and the negative answer to it.
Absolutely. Under circumstances of a case like this, absolutely. But then again, the question becomes, do they even have to exercise due diligence given the fact that it was a discovery violation? We're going to have a potential Brady issue. Brady doesn't require due diligence by defense counsel. It requires...
Is it your view this is a Brady document or only a potential Brady document?
Well, it's a Brady document because it does undermine confidence in the verdict. 2 years ago, this court said United States versus Fletcher that a positive urinalysis result does not automatically lead to...
So the government does not have to produce under Brady exculpatory information if it wouldn't undermine confidence in the verdict. So they sit back and make a judgment about what needs to be produced or not? Is that your standard?
No, that's not, Your Honor.
So is this or is this not Brady?
Well, it is Brady. It's Brady for the first reason because it does undermine confidence in the verdict. My understanding of the case law is that it is material if that's true. But also from the case law we understand is that if it's favorable evidence that either goes to the guilt or innocence of the defendant or if it could impact the credibility of a witness, then the prudent prosecutor is going to disclose it. Whether or not it's technically Brady material at that point, obviously we're not going to know until after the fact. But the fact of the matter is that if it is favorable, then it should be disclosed. It becomes a Brady violation if it's material, and it is material in this case. But that raises a good point, is that if this is not found to be, if this suppressed evidence is found to be harmless, then it raises the question as to when will an Article 15 not be harmless? Because in this case, we don't just have just one Article 15 for a dishonesty offense. We have all the ensuing documentation and all the years that Sergeant Heron served as an observer signing those documents that do further than just the Article 15 itself. And it would give, if it's determined to be harmless, it would give trial counsel license to determine the scope of his search for potential Brady material. It would give trial counsel license to decide whether or not he should disclose an Article 15 or not. Because we have to remember in this case what trial counsel did, whether or not he was doing it in bad faith or good faith, never found out what defenses were. All he did is he found out that there was an Article 15, but he himself, without asking what defenses were, determined on his own that it didn't affect credibility. The military judge simply did not do anything unreasonable in making her findings of fact or reaching her conclusions of law. This court should therefore affirm. If there are no further questions on this issue, if I could just briefly make one more point regarding the second certified issue, and that is that this court has recognized in a long list of cases, United States versus Brickey, United States versus Griffith, United States versus Scaff, and McDottie, that a military judge does possess significant post-trial remedial powers. There is no substantive distinction between 1102 and 1210. And when this court decided SCAF, it did conclude that a military judge, regarding especially Article 39A, does have significant post-trial powers. And nothing has changed this view since, either by this court or otherwise. And that makes sense, because prior to trial or prior to authentication, again, the military judge owns the record. And it just makes sense for the military judge to be able to correct the manifest injustice when it appears before it, to remedy it soonest. It's going to benefit everybody. It benefits the accused, obviously. It benefits the government. And it's going to benefit the military justice system. So in sum, the military judge did not abuse her discretion in granting a new trial, and she did have the authority to do so.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
In regards to the first issue, the appellee argued that the Article 15 by the observer is a critical point in Both as to him as an individual credibility, but mainly the defense argument stems off of the fact that an Article 15 by this observer is going to affect the entire validity of the collection process at Portland Air Force Base.
Well, why wouldn't it if there were seven prior examples of that over the last 4 years?
And the government's position on that is that it certainly could have. However, the defense in this case did not interview anybody in that would have been critical in that defense, and there is no evidence in the record other than this Article 15 by the observer of any other problems whatsoever at Kirtland Air Force Base. So to say that now it puts into light a whole issue with the Kirtland collection process is whether you believe that or not, based on the record that is before you, there is definitely evidence that you have an observer that served that should not have served according to the AFI, that he has served numerous times prior to this, but you have no other evidence before you of any other problems in the collection process at Kirtland Air Force Base.
But isn't the point is not whether or not there are problems with the collection process at Kirtland. The problem is that by not knowing this, the defense was deprived of the opportunity to make inquiries into it.
Well, and on that point, the government would respectfully disagree in the sense of the defense had the ability to inquire of both the observer and Ms. Stenson.
But they made the discovery request, and they did not get a response. And so, based upon that, are they to assume that the government is covering something up, and in every situation like that, they are required to make further inquiry? Or can they not rely upon the discovery process and the obligations under Brady?
Certainly they can rely upon the discovery process. However, as Judge Ryan stated, in a quote-unquote naked ear analysis case, you essentially have three defenses. You have the attack on the lab, you have the attack on the collection process, and you have an innocent ingestion. And in this case, the defense did not even explore the collection process. Now, the Article 15 by the observer certainly would have been good to know. It would have highlighted maybe we should ask some more questions. However, there are many other potential issues that could have been found at the collection process had they performed a few interviews.
But, I mean, there's a presumption of regularity with respect to the collection process, right? I mean, that's what the military judge will instruct on unless there's a problem that's highlighted. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think that the argument here is that the defense didn't have the ability to make a meaningful decision to pursue that strategy because they were basically informed that everything was copacetic and there was no problem.
Yes, Your Honor. And the government would agree with that. However, the appellant's argument said that there was nothing questioned regarding the collection, regarding the test. And as a matter of fact, in trial, the defense actually did question the expert regarding certain disciplinary infractions by other members that worked at the lab and went into the people who handled the sample at the lab and prior disciplinary issues at the lab and those type of things. So there was some cross-examination of the government expert regarding the validity of the process at the lab that was presented at trial. Additionally, the defense then went on to put on the innocent ingestion defense. And so even if the defense was granted a new trial in this case and they fully explored the collection process at Kirtland and they put up all of the errors that we know of on the record today, we're still looking at the fact that the accused testified in the first trial, and that testimony would be admissible, arguably, under RCM 810. So even if the defense put forth the defense of, you know, who knows if this was collected properly, you still have potentially admissible evidence of the accused's testimony in the first trial where he says that was my urine in the bottle and there was no problem with the bottle and there was no problem with the tamper-resistant tape being placed.
Because I want to go back to Judge Baker's earlier question about, you know, about the important issue that the government is appealing here, because it seems to me that leaving aside the issue of judicial estoppel, which we will rule on in due course, it seems to me that it is clear that the position of the government in this case is different than the position of the other services in two prior cases heard last month on the same Article 62 issue. And it would seem to me that in light of that fact, and in light of the fact that it is a Department of Defense and a Joint Services Committee, et cetera, that there would be an important issue that the Air Force is asking us to resolve in this case before they would part ways with the other services. So what is that important issue?
The issue would be providing ruling regarding the military judge's authority in a post-trial 39A to find for a new trial in contrary to Article 73. So if there are no further questions, I'll briefly conclude. In this case, the military judge abused her discretion in granting a new trial during the post-trial 39A. There is no manifest injustice that would occur in this case, given the facts that were presented at the original trial. And this court can have the utmost confidence in the outcome of that case and that it would not be different. Accordingly, further, the government asserts that based upon Article 73, the military judge did not have the proper authority to grant a new trial in this case. However, clearly, the government agrees that RCM 1102 allowed for the military judge to hold the Article 39A session under the proper circumstances. Accordingly, the government asks this court to set aside the Air Force opinion and send the case back so that the community authority can take action. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel from both parties for your submission today. The case is now submitted, and the court will soon in recess until 9:55 a.m.
The court stands in recess until 9:55.